Good evening. We're a band of brothers who've worked together for a long time. What will be at the end of this hour, no one knows. We did have a brief meeting yesterday in which we agreed upon an agenda, but no one knows what the other fellow is going to say. And unless someone is cheating, I am the only one here who has a note in front of him. I anticipate that before the hour is over, certain differences of opinion may arise. Gentlemen, in case anyone has forgotten you during your absence, perhaps you would begin by identifying yourselves.
I'm Winston Burdett. I'm based in Rome, but my main beat this year has been Africa.
I'm Howard K. Smith, and I cover Washington.
I'm Richard Hottolett. I cover the United Nations.
I'm David Schoenbrunn. I cover French affairs and NATO out of Paris.
I'm Daniel Shaw, stationed in Bonn, covering Germany and Eastern Europe.
Alexander Kendrick, London.
Peter Kalischer, I cover the Far East, and I've just come through Soviet Central Asia.
My name is Marvin Kalb. I cover Moscow.
What's the most important current development in your areas?
Well, this has been the year in which the continent of Africa, or at any rate the newly independent nations of Black Africa, have burst with a roar on the stage of world politics. I think the most important current development is the direct result of this wave of independence. We're seeing now an entirely new factor on the African scene. It's the Soviet entry, the entry of the Soviet bloc into African politics, and the beginning of a new struggle for Africa.
Well, in the United States, quite obviously, the most important development is the transition in power from the oldest president we've ever had and an avowed believer in a passive presidency to the youngest elected president we've ever had and avowed believer in an active, not to say a hyperthyroid, presidency.
The United Nations reflects developments and it shows us a world in rapid and ominous change. New nations are crowding on the scene, unstable, uncommitted, changing the arithmetic of power all the time. The Soviets show us strength and brute force and determination. We don't know exactly where we're going and raise the risk of collision by miscalculation. And in all this, the UN, which is still the main hope for peace in the world and in outer space, is being strangled.
In my area, we're witnessing the final fever of France in Algeria. It's the kind of fever that doctors look for, long for, but fear, because it signals the end of the disease or the end of the patient. That's going to end one way or the other in 1961, that's for sure. Nobody doubts for a moment now that Algeria will be free. The question is, how will Algeria be free? Will it get freedom like India, like Madagascar, join a community of nations, or will it get freedom like the Congo? One way lies hope, the other way, complete disaster for France, for Europe, for us too. And it can go either way.
In my area, or let me say the area in which I work, I don't consider it much mine, the most important current development, and it is very current, is that trade agreements have been signed finally by West Germany with Russia and with East Germany, important as an indication that we will not have a Berlin crisis at the new year, important as a symbol of the fact that Khrushchev is waiting for President Kennedy and that all the trouble we may still have, we will not have for another 2 or 3 months.
In Britain, the most important development was not the marriage at long last of Princess Margaret. I think it was the decision of the British government to abandon the British independent nuclear deterrent, thereby encouraging the forces of the anti-nuclear and neutralist forces in Britain, helping to create a split in the Labour Party over defense policy, which led finally to a vote by the Labour Party conference for unilateral nuclear disarmament. And I think this situation also posed once again very vividly the question, how long do we go on with the nuclear arms race?
In my area, I think it's the emergence of communist China, a nation of 650 million people, as the new standard bearer of world revolution. A nation which now stands on the threshold of exploding its own atomic device, which it made mainly by its own efforts. And a nation with which we still have no relations with all the problems that this brings up.
In my area, it's a little bit of what Pete was just talking about. For the first time in 43 years, the Soviet Union finds itself on the defensive in the ideological and diplomatic spheres in the world communist movement. And this fact, I think, has already had an adverse effect upon Premier Khrushchev's position at home.
What was the most important development on the whole planet, in your view, Winston?
Well, since I spent most of this year in Africa, I'm tempted to say that Africa's march towards independence was the biggest thing, but I don't really think it was. Historically, it seems to me, the biggest thing was something that was happening behind our backs, and it's what Pete Kalischer just mentioned, the emergence of a third world power, Red China.
Well, almost naturally, with my special viewpoint, I think that the impending switch of the White House lawn from a putting green to a touch football field is the biggest development in the world today.
Well, I agree with Howard. The American election, with this promise of new vigor and new movement and new power in the new administration, is the most important thing.
Ed, I'm not sure. Future historians may decide that it was something a French scientist did last week in filming a living cell for the first time. Maybe the most important thing on the planet is getting off the planet. I think we'll have a man in space next year. We're going to go out of this world, and perhaps that's the best thing of all.
At the risk of seeming jocular, a risk I'm glad to take.
Good.
I'll say that for one who has spent most of this year either on the Iron Curtain while following Nikita Khrushchev around here and there, the most important thing on this planet at the end of this year is that we still have a planet.
That's very jocular.
Yeah, sir. History may record that it was the discovery of a nuclear potential in Israel, thereby proving that even the smallest of powers can have the atomic bomb.
I'm afraid I have to go back to Howard's original contention on the election, but with a sort of a reverse twist, because I think this has given the people in my area, Japan, Southeast Asia, a new hope in American leadership. I should say a hope for American leadership, which they felt has been lacking for, I won't say how many years.
8, perhaps?
Perhaps 10.
I have a feeling that possibly the most significant thing this year is one of the least publicized things this year. A conference of scientists that took place last month in Moscow. It was called the Pugwash Conference. And there, for the first time, really, scientists from East and West sat down and really worked out a detailed program on disarmament. It was not only Russian and American scientists that met there. There were also 4 scientists from Communist China, 3 of whom, by the way, were trained and picked up their PhDs in the United States.
How would you characterize this year, Howard?
Well, I think I would characterize this year as the year the ideas ran out, in the United States especially. The UN, on which we've leaned for policy, has been paralyzed and is paralyzed. Laos has proved that you cannot, with foreign aid, buy anti-communism. And 8 years of what is called fiscal responsibility have produced the third recession that we've been in. And Cuba has shown that containment no longer is possible.
Marvin?
I would say that this is the year we peaked when we shouldn't have and we got caught. And now a Virginian pilot named Francis Gary Powers is taking the rap in a Soviet jail for a major goof in American U-2 diplomacy.
Schoenberg?
Ed, I think this is the year of the takeover generation. Men in their 40s and boys in their 20s have taken power in the United States. They've overthrown governments in Korea and Turkey. I think based upon that, my advice to people next year is be nice to the kiddies. They may be in power.
Kendrick?
I think it was the year of the big wind. 2 big winds, in fact. The wind of change in Africa and the east wind from China.
Well, it seems to me that there have been a great many changes in personal leadership in the course of the last year. Some of them actual, some of them just over the horizon, potential. Any comments, Howard?
Well, I think our change is about as drastic a change as you can have under constitutional government. I've emphasized the fact that the presidents and their intents have differed drastically, but the men around them differ too. The emphasis in the previous administration was on businessmen. At present, I think scholars probably have a plurality. It's said that if all the appointees made by Kennedy so far were to walk down the hall together, there would be a deafening jangle of Phi Beta Kappa keys, and there are 3 Rhodes scholars among them. Many of them are famed for some very useful and active ideas. But the main thing that induces me to believe this will be an active administration is the fact that there has seldom been, since the Civil War, such an accumulation of crises and merely problems as there is now, and we have to act or there will be disaster.
Well, the name of this program, Years of Crisis, has been rather durable, hasn't it, over the last 12 years? Burdett?
Well, in Africa, the change in leadership this year has been revolutionary. The peoples of 17 former colonies have become independent, and the era of European domination in Africa, after 300 years, has drawn to a close. The leaders of this new Africa are men of widely different stamp and character. Some of them, like Prime Minister Balewa of Nigeria, are balanced and moderate men. Others, like Lumumba in the Congo, are extremists in action and emotion. But all of them this year have had one experience in common, and that is that independence has released a flood of new problems far bigger than any of them expected. And in their need and in their contest for power, these leaders are ready to seek help and allies anywhere. And in 1960, many of them have found out that they can get help and encouragement at least as fast from Moscow as they can from Washington.
Well, there's no imminent change of leadership in France, but it's got to come someday, I suppose. And when it does, it's going to be a very radical change. Not a change of generations, but a change of centuries. De Gaulle is not just a man of the 19th century, he's a man of the 15th century. A great giant who lives in the past, looks at the future, but doesn't really understand or like the present very much. But there are new leaders in France. Young men, 40 years old, like the men Howard was talking about, with the French equivalent of Phi Beta Kappa Keys. Men like McNamara, who began their careers as accountants. And a very curious thing, poetic accountants, visionary engineers, men who dream in blueprints. Very strange. For them, the great symphony of Bach is the wine of an automated chain. There's going to be a very real difference because the France that de Gaulle lived in is dead forever. That kind of dream is gone, and there's going to be not only new leaders, but a very new country.
Dan Shore? It's interesting to contrast West Germany with France, because West Germany faces an election this year, and the chances are that Konrad Adenauer, who will be 85 years old a week from today, will be elected again if he's fit to run. The chances are he will be fit to run, although after a two-week illness, he looked a little peaked when I saw him last week. If he should not run, and I don't predict he won't run, hardy man that he is, the leadership that will take over will be less dedicated to integration. Adenauer today is the man who really believes in integration, the economics minister Erhard, who might be his successor, Strauss, defense minister, who would like to be his successor but may not make it. All of these men are men committed to the materialism and the prosperity and the great success and the let's not experiment in West Germany. They're being challenged, for the first time really challenged, by a young social democrat named Willy Brandt of West Berlin. The first one who may give Adenauer a bit of a run for his money, but without much chance of winning this election if Adenauer runs. A man who's running very much on a Kennedy type of New Frontiers platform, who has pretty much scrapped Marxism as the basis of their policy, and who will maintain the kind of general leadership that Adenauer has maintained today in foreign affairs. Let me add just one word about Eastern Europe. The leadership there, or at least the control there, has remained amazingly and depressingly stable, for the most part, with no change at all or none in sight, except in Albania, which is Russia's Cuba.
Dan, what you said is very interesting. It sounds to me as though there's a real change. The new young Germans who will follow Adenauer are not for integration, they're against the common market, and this whole development towards a united Europe.
I wouldn't say it's so sharply that they're against it. They don't have Adenauer's dream and vision and enthusiasm about the common market, and without that dream, and since de Gaulle is against it, it doesn't have much chance.
You talk about integration, you mean integrated armed forces or what?
Well, I actually meant economic integration of Europe, but let's talk about armed forces as well. It applies there, too.
Dick Hollett, you want to add anything to this?
Well, there's certainly impending change at the UN. The Russians are out as savagely as ever to get rid of Dag Hammarskjöld, who, of course, got in their way in the Congo, frustrated their ambitions. And they're also out to wreck the Secretariat as an agency which would be capable of preventive diplomacy in the future. And if they can get the support of some of the neutral countries in the General Assembly, they might very well cause Hammarskjöld to resign, although he is a very tough little man. In any case, his term expires in April 63, which is a little more than 2 years from now, and if the Russians swing enough votes, they can make sure that the man who succeeds Hammarskjöld, if there is to be one at all, is one to their liking. Now, this, of course, makes neutralism very much of a factor in American policy,
as President Eisenhower recognized when he made his speech at the General Assembly in September.
Dick, I have the feeling that there has occurred in this country a considerable change in our attitude towards neutralism. There was a time a few years ago when we thought that neutralism was somehow immoral. But now we seem to have agreed that it is, at times, useful.
But the existence of a strong and determined United Nations, faithful to the UN Charter, is completely in harmony with American vital interests. What we have to worry about is the kind of mischievous, tilted neutralism that some of our uncommitted friends indulge in.
Dick, aren't there two kinds of neutralism? There's the neutralism of these emerging new countries. There's also an incipient neutralism among some of our staunch allies. I mean, there's a growing current of neutralism, let us say, in Britain and other places. But don't we have to regard these two things differently? I mean, I think we'd be less inclined to look with a benign attitude toward the change by an ally to neutralism than we would at a new neutralism of a new country.
Well, exactly, because the change of an ally to a neutral is a net loss,
whereas the maintenance
of stable neutrality by an uncommitted country, I think, works in our favor if we know where we stand and what to do with it.
All right, have we really changed our attitude toward neutralism, in your view?
I think we have. I think we've resigned ourselves to it the way you resign yourself to a wall which you've batted your head against and which won't move. The number of neutrals has increased. We have seen such alarming contrasts as the fact that the president was received in India, a neutralist country linked to us in no special way. He was received enthusiastically. His reception in Japan, a country tied to us as an ally, did not even occur. It was so unenthusiastic. This has given rise to the thought that perhaps the best thing we can get is neutralist nations. We have to settle for the fact, I think, that some nations don't believe the Cold War is the most important thing in the world. Some think their own self-development is, and we've got to work with them on that basis.
Sure. Kelly, sir?
I've something to say on that. If this policy of accepting neutralism as being morally acceptable in high places, I don't think that it's gotten down to the operational level in all places, Howard, and particularly in Laos. Now, Laos is a country that's a neutralist natural, and that's a fluff phrase if ever I heard one.
Congratulations.
But now it's tucked away in what used to be French Indochina, 2 million people, 90% of whom don't really care who runs the government, and most of whom don't even know where the capital is.
There are two.
There
are two capitals.
Well, that's right. That's what confuses them.
Confuses me, too.
And this country, of course, was neutral for a while after the settlement at Geneva in 1954, and then a pro-American premier came into power. Well, just last summer, there was a coup d'etat after we had spent several hundred million dollars trying to convince these people that they should be pro-American in a very great way. And now the premier who came back was the same neutralist premier who we dealt with in 1954, but somehow we didn't choose to deal with him. A defense minister whom we backed started a counter-revolution. Immediately, the Chinese communists jumped in on the other side. There's only one constant about this country. It's a buffer, a geographic buffer between communist China and Thailand, our ally, our CETO ally, and also a sort of a buffer on the flank of South Vietnam. And neither we nor the Chinese communists can stand for a government that is completely on the other side. Consequently, a neutralist government would be great. And all our efforts to indoctrinate these people, I think, are going to fail, and we may get into very serious consequences if we persist in ramming down a very pro-American government on these people. I mean, $300 million didn't change their minds before, and $300 million more again.
Pete, how much weight do you give to these threats from Russia and China about a second Korea in Laos?
I think that they could very well be. I don't think it will be as big a Korea as Korea, because Laos doesn't lend itself to that kind of fighting.
But it doesn't really make any sense to fight in Laos, does it?
Well, it doesn't make any sense to anybody as long as the country remains a neutral. As soon as it becomes one side or the other side begins to feel that it's a threat. It's an avenue.
Winston, the neutrals were pretty useful in the Congo, weren't they?
They were, of course. And, of course, the whole purpose of the United Nations and of the United States in backing the United Nations when the UN went into the Congo and took over responsibility there The whole purpose was to neutralize the country, to keep the big powers out of it and prevent it from becoming a Cold War battlefield. So in that sense, I think it's true to say that our backing of the UN was a big step toward accepting the idea of neutralism. But still, the Congo was a special case. It was an emergency. And I think that our diplomats in the field are still a very long way from accepting political neutralism as a way of life for the new countries. We are still scared by neutralists. We still get alarmed whenever any little country calls in some Soviet technicians. And the fact is that most of the African countries, the new ones, do not want to take sides in the Cold War. They're much too engrossed in their own problems to worry about the East and West. I think we've got to approach them now in an entirely new frame of mind. We should not only accept their neutralism, we should encourage it. Because as long as they are genuinely neutral, this is the best possible defense and way to strengthen their independence.
But the operative word there is genuinely.
Absolutely.
I think it's very interesting here that it was an issue just like neutralism that brought to the fore this past year the whole rift, the open rift between the Russians and the Chinese. Because the Russians have felt all along that you can use neutralism as a way of advancing the goal of world communism, but the Chinese have adopted a kind of a John Foster Dulles psychology about neutralism. If you're not with us, you're against us. And the entire dispute was really cloaked in various cliches, ideological cliches about peaceful coexistence, the inevitability of war, the non-inevitability of war. But the fact is, the Russians and the Chinese, despite an overriding allegiance to world communism, were really arguing about policy, diplomacy, and influence in different parts of the world.
But didn't they settle in this new communist manifesto on an approach, broad, united front approach?
Well, not only that, this question of nationalist democracies, this is a new concept that the Chinese evidently have accepted now, and the Russians use the term for the first time, nationalist democracies, meaning the newly emerging countries, which they hope to convert into neutrals.
That's right, but I think that a reading of that document indicates that the Chinese have not fully accepted this point. I don't think so, because it was an issue like this on national democracy and an issue such as peaceful coexistence that everyone agreed on. But I don't think there was ever any real difference of opinion on peaceful coexistence. Before Liu Shaoqi came to that conference, the Chinese had said they agree with the Russian Khrushchev position on peaceful coexistence. But the document that they signed, 81 communist parties gathering together in an atmosphere of absolute secrecy, it was one of the most extraordinary meetings in the last 40 years of communist history.
Nothing like that since the old Comintern days, really.
That's right. Yes. And what they signed there was a document that in substance may have been Russian, but in spirit and in intention, if I can use that kind of word here, was really Chinese. Because at that conference, two very important things happened. The first is that communist China emerged, as Pete said before, as an alternate source of ideological inspiration in the world communist movement. They were gaining influence at the expense of the Russian Communist Party. And the second thing is that in 1956, when the Chinese emerged from centuries of Asian seclusion to mediate a Russian dispute with Hungary and Poland, what the Chinese have done now is go and extend their influence well beyond Europe. They've extended their influence into
Latin America,
Africa.
You know, it was interesting at the UN to see how Khrushchev worked hard to get the Chinese into the United Nations. He said there would be no disarmament, there would be no normal functioning of the UN until Red China was there. He even in that connection dropped this hint of walking out of the UN altogether and setting up a communist UN. And there was this dismal joke after his pounding of the table and the rest that he sent a message to Beiping saying, "Look, Mao, I'm dancing."
And you know,
would the Russians agree with you that the Chinese have won?
Well, in the first place, you have on this one hand this business of Khrushchev trying to bring the Chinese into the UN, as Dick says, and at the same time there's a struggle for power in every communist party in Asia between the Chinese group and the Russian group. Now, the Russians are still nominally in command in Japan, for instance, but the number one man, Nosaka, spent the war years in China, in Yunnan.
Yeah.
And one can only suppose, that you get very little of what goes on inside, one can only suppose that the Chinese power in the Japan Communist Party is on the ascendant.
I think we could even go one step beyond that. I think that if we were to check the individual histories of the communist parties of all of the Southeast Asian countries over the last 5 years, we would have found a definite swing toward a communist Chinese point of view. This is particularly true, by the way, of the Indonesian Communist Party, which is the second leading communist party in Asia.
It's also interesting that the satellite communist leaders coming back from this conference have spoken more frankly about the existence of differences in Moscow than I've ever seen them speak before. They've spoken about some comrades who raised this point and some comrades who thought that, indicating rather outspokenly that there were disagreements. And in Budapest just last week, a communist said, the most impressive thing about the communist declaration of Moscow is that there was a joint declaration. In other words, there must have been a time when it was very dubious if there'd be any agreement on any declaration at all.
It's good to hear they're having their trouble.
Naturally, the biggest concern in this country is what it means for the United States. I would like to ask you, Marvin, is the following view close to accuracy? The view here is, I think, that in the long run, there's bound to be friction or some kind of a conflict between the Chinese and the Russian communists. But in the short run, we have absolutely nothing to gain from it because Khrushchev will be eternally trying to prove he's not soft on capitalism by being tough to us.
I would certainly agree with that 100% because I think there's a great fallacy in believing that any dispute between the Russians and the Chinese is necessarily something good for us. Not necessarily at all, because the kind of conference they just had there proved that the whole nature of world communism has changed. It is no longer the kind of thing it was under Stalin's time. It is now a far more viable,
flexible,
dedicated, flexible form, and they can move ahead and create far more problems for us than they ever could before.
Well, they're doing it right now in Algeria, for example. When Ferhat Abbas went to Beijing and was received by Mao, Mao said to him, I hope that you are mature enough not to negotiate peace with the French, but to win your revolution on your own. And it's no coincidence with this Chinese line that Khrushchev broke with the French after a long stall and now began to attack the French on Algerian policy following the Chinese.
Do you know that
but
there's a clash?
But it still hasn't gone all the way, and I think that's very interesting.
Just a minute. Do you know that there's still a clash between the Chinese communist ideology and Chinese nationalism? For instance, let's not overlook the fact that in Indonesia and in India, India, because of territorial grabs by the Chinese, there is a tremendous anti-Chinese sentiment. And the same for quite a different reason in Indonesia. It's an anti-Chinese because the Chinese in Indonesia are the smartest merchants. Mm. And they are trying to circumscribe their activities. Peking has decided that they are going to champion these small capitalists. And there you have a situation where the revolutionary Chinese are standing up for the capitalist Chinese against Indonesians who they are a revolutionary society on the side of, in principle, revolutionary red China.
It seems to me we're a people given to sudden enthusiasms, and now we're concerned about emerging nations. Isn't there the possibility that we concentrate on them so much that we lose or at least weaken our ties with our traditional allies? Howard?
I don't think so at all, Ed. I have seen this view expressed in British papers which I receive, but one of the last acts of President Eisenhower is doing something I don't understand yet, and that is offering a nuclear deterrent to the European allies. One of the first steps of the new Secretary of State, Mr. Dean Rusk, has been to issue a statement expressing his heartfelt feeling of cooperation with Europe. And in fact, with some of the emergent countries, if Latin America may be included in that category, I don't think we're showing them enough attention. The new president-elect has appointed an Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs to exhibit his interest in Africa. He's appointed a former Asian expert as his Secretary of State, but so far nothing has been done to give solace to an area of the world which I expect to be more explosive than any of the other underdeveloped areas, and that is Latin America.
Kalischer?
Well, I don't think so at all. I don't think we're risking any old friends. I think if we take a look at the emerging African nations today, we'll see that they stand in almost the same position that the newly independent nations of Asia did 15 years ago. Now, at that time, we recognized these nations, but we were so careful of our friendships and alliances with the old world, with France and England and the other colonial powers, that we somehow never gave them the impression that we were really with them. We gave them aid, but we chided them about playing with the boys on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And we gave them aid, and we told them that, yes, It was good to be independent, but we must go slow. Now, today we're faced with these new nations, and we've got a chance now to get in on the ground floor. It may be too late, but I think we can get in on the ground floor. And I think it isn't just enough to applaud these nations from the side. We've got to get a brass band and get at the head of the line and cheer ourselves hoarse. And as in the case of Algeria, I think the French have to realize this. They've got to lump it.
David, do you think there's a danger that we're concentrating too much of our effort and interest in the underdeveloped areas and neglecting our traditional allies?
Well, not now. I mean, after all, to judge a danger, we've got to judge what Mr. Kennedy is going to do, and I haven't got the slightest clue as to what Mr. Kennedy is going to do, but I've heard a lot of speculation about what Mr. Kennedy is going to do, and they've heard a lot of it in Europe, and they are very genuinely concerned about the fact that Mr. Kennedy is African-minded, Asian-minded. I'm sure the Europeans don't quite understand what Mr. Kennedy means by this. I'm not sure I understand it either, but I'd like to make a guess about it. I think if I know Kennedy's people and people around him, what he is saying in effect is, we've helped Europe get back on its feet. It's back on its feet. We don't have to help Europe anymore. They've got a dollar surplus. We have a dollar gap. The real problem now is to save freedom and democracy in Africa and Asia. This is a job for Europe to do with the United States. I think if Mr. Kennedy explains this to the Europeans, these fears will disappear. But if they do anything like what our friend Peter here has suggested, saying to the French, if you don't like it, you can lump it in Algeria, we're going to get a lump on our head about this big, because if we try to trade off Europe for Algeria, we're going to just come unstuck. That's just no way to approach this thing.
Well, at the UN, we've fallen right between the two stools. We're not winning new friends, and we're not keeping old friends. Matter of fact, the old friends are a lot more trouble than they're worth, and Algeria is a fine case.
No, but you think that Great Britain and France are a lot more trouble than they're worth? That's an astonishing remark.
Dick. Let me explain. If you'll just wait a moment, I'll explain. The French put the arm on us to support their policy that Algeria is strictly an internal concern of France. This is something with which we are not in sympathy. We went along with the French up to a point, earned their criticism, and probably rightly so, because we weren't consistent enough and we violated our own principles. The Asians and Africans came along with a resolution far more in accord with what we believe, that Algeria is an international problem and should be solved under international auspices for everybody's
like the
benefit.
UN We
abstained there. We did not follow our best instincts, and we are now being lambasted by the Asians and Africans as colonialists. On the issue of colonialism, the shoe was on the British foot. The Asian African powers presented a perfectly acceptable resolution on colonialism, which we were minded to go along with when Mr. McMillan got hold of Mr. Eisenhower in Augusta, Georgia, and while the U.S. delegation at the U.N. tore its hair, we abstained. And we were among nine who abstained when the thing went through unanimously. And we were in very excellent company. The Dominican Republic, the Union of South Africa, Spain, Portugal, and the rest. And the Soviets had wonderful ammunition to call us colonialists.
Dick, look, now just take Algeria. De Gaulle has said in Algeria that it has a right to be free and can choose its freedom. He has personally come out in favor of an Algerian republic. What do you want to do, vote against that?
No, but he came out very late in the day, and the French position that Algeria is part of France and is an internal French concern.
You're whipping a dead horse.
I'm not whipping a dead horse. The French abstained to the very last minute.
The French
in the
are
UN.
Saying that the UN are not competent to regulate the Algerian problem. And after what I and I like to hear Winston on this have seen in the Congo, I'd say they're very
right.
But
the UN was not going to regulate the Algerian.
Gentlemen, speaking of dead horses, let's change horses. We aren't going to solve the Algerian business certainly in the course of the next 20 minutes.
We cannot leave the subject without saying that there is one country that is most seriously concerned about a change of emphasis in American policy away from Europe towards Asia and Africa, and that is West Germany. Not that West Germany can stand on its own feet economically, but West Germany does feel that the problem of Berlin needs constant attention. And if that attention flags for a minute as we become concerned with other things, then Berlin will simply slip away. And there is serious concern about this in West Germany.
Winston?
Well, Ed, I don't think for a moment that we're being carried away by enthusiasm, as you said, for the emergent countries, and I don't think that we're putting too much emphasis on aid to these countries. In fact, I think there ought to be more emphasis and a new start, a drastic revision and a revolution in our whole concept and techniques of aiding the backward countries. There's a revolutionary situation right now in Africa with all the new needs of the new nations, and 0.4 technical advisors sitting in offices are no longer good enough. We've got to be able to give these countries the aid that they ask for, that they want, and not dictate to them the kind of aid which we think they should have. We ought to help them on the grassroots level, working with them and alongside them and training them as we go along. Their biggest need, of course, is education, and I think we ought to flood them with teachers so that one day they themselves can staff their civil service and their courts and their schools and so on. Well, our whole future relationship with Africa depends on our success in doing things like this, and I think we can do them without risking old friends in Europe.
Has confidence in American leadership diminished? And if it has, what can be done to reestablish or reinforce it? Howard?
Well, I gather that it has. I gather this from newspapers I read, from friends I have in foreign countries, and from many other indices. And I think what we have to do is to indicate that we have a plan, we have plans and policies, we know what to do, and that we have the will to do it. We have to have a good foreign policy. And 80% of a good foreign policy is having a sound domestic base. And the first thing we have to do to secure a sound domestic base is to enliven our economy. The real reason we're having gold and dollar difficulties at present is that our economy is lagging, and investments that usually stay in this country are going to more profitable countries like West Germany, Switzerland, and other countries. If our economy picks up, if it is stimulated, then this investment money will come back and our problem will be lessened. I think we have to institute a new regime in industry. We have to persuade labor, and I feel almost sure that that's why an AFL-CIO man was chosen to be Secretary of Labor, that it can't have its annual increment, its annual rise. It can be proved that that rise doesn't amount to anything because prices go up and take it away. Profits can't go up. Instead, they've got to lower prices instead. Then we'll be more competitive and we'll solve our dollar and gold problems. Then we can solve all our internal problems, mainly the one of education, the one that interests me most. I assume we're going to face an educational crisis in this country, but that's just one of many things that we can do to enliven our domestic base on which to build a sound foreign policy. And if I can just speak for a second more, I would build that policy around the United Nations and try to get the United Nations to, I think you could get an African-Asian vote behind a move to declare Africa off bounds for the Cold War. Let the only aid that goes into Africa go through the UN. The only technicians that go into Africa go through the UN. Let the only military arms that go through the UN. Then this competition between America and Russia for each new nation in Africa which can breed war would stop. I think those are the sorts of things we have to do.
Eisenhower proposed that but didn't follow through.
No.
Well, David, has confidence in our leadership diminished in France, would you say?
Well, all through Europe, I'd agree with what Howard said. Confidence is a factor based upon the image of America. Not an image that's been created by image makers, but a real image. What kind of an image have we had over in Europe in the last few weeks? Mr. Anderson coming over, hat in hand, asking the Germans, please help us, we're so poor. Eisenhower is saying to the army, send your wives and children home, we can't afford to keep you there. Well, you don't have confidence with that sort of a situation. May I say, however, that although confidence has declined in that respect, that the European knowledge of the fact that American leadership is basic to the free world, that they are dependent upon us, has not changed one little bit, and the reservoir of confidence in us is very great indeed and can be restored very rapidly if only just a few of the things that Howard has been saying are done.
Alex?
Well, I think there's been some loss in American leadership, but I don't think it was mainly due to overt error, unless you want to list the acknowledgement of responsibility for the U-2 flight as an error. I think many people in Europe feel that we sort of missed the boat, that we have failed to gear ourselves to this new communist dynamism that the boys from that part of the world have been talking about, that we have failed to recognize there's been a change in the locale of the East-West contest from Europe to the colonial, to the ex-colonial countries. Now, I don't think that we have to choose between Africa and Europe. I think that we can join with Europe in helping to develop the underdeveloped countries. But I think in order to do that, we've got to do something about more unity in Europe. And I think one thing we can do, in spite of what Dan has said about the diminishing appeal of the common market in Germany, I think one thing we can do is not to favor the European common market in itself and for itself, but to do something about bringing the 6 of the European common market together with the 7 of the European free trade area. Then I think, reflecting a European view, that in Europe also, we could do something about disarmament. I think perhaps we could look at the old British plan, the so-called Eden, Gateskill, Macmillan plan for a ceiling on armaments in Central Europe on both sides of the Iron Curtain. And above all, I don't believe that the introduction of longer-ranged missiles in Europe is going to help reduce tensions in Europe.
Dan? In the main, I agree with what my three friends have said. I just want to add one point to all of this, which may be a little more encouraging. It is true that we've lost, for all the reasons mentioned, a great deal of the confidence of Europe, and nowhere more than in West Germany. Not only sitting in Bonn and watching Secretary Anderson and Undersecretary Dillon arrive to not to ask for hat in hand, but to demand money, but also the mention by Secretary Herder at the NATO conference in Paris of the possibility of redeployment in troops. That kind of thing has really tended to shake the confidence of West Germany. But the confidence of West Germany was shaken long before. The U-2 and the whole period during the summer and the vacuum of the American election campaign started a kind of movement among America's old men to try to unite among themselves and see if they couldn't put one over on whoever the young man would become in America as president. And there was a certain sense of motion in Europe, and Macmillan went to Bonn and Adenauer planned to go to Paris and to London to see if they couldn't seize the initiative for themselves, because partly they were losing confidence in America. But then something happened. They found that they couldn't decide anything and they couldn't really settle anything without America. And because there wasn't a new American president in office, all the problems which they'd hoped to settle without us, they couldn't settle. And so they found the common market needed America to help to bring it together with the outer seven. They found that they couldn't decide on their defense until we had a real proposal on nuclear weapons. And the whole thing kind of ground to a halt, and Adenauer, partly because he was ill, but for other reasons as well, called off the visits and everything waited. What I'm trying to say is that while Europe has felt, on the whole, that we have fumbled the ball, no one has picked up that ball from us. And we still have it. And Kennedy can do what he wants with it because they're waiting for it.
That's quite right. The lack of confidence has nothing to do with their knowledge of dependence upon us.
Marvin, how are our prospects for leadership as viewed by the Russians?
Well, the Russians have never thought very much about American leadership. But there's a very weird kind of...
Much of it.
There's a weird kind of contradiction in all of this. Because at the same time as Khrushchev is the first one to state that the United States has become a second-rate power, and that the Soviet Union, the finance minister said in Moscow just last week, the Soviet Union has already outstripped the United States in overall production, and very shortly will outstrip the United States in per capita production. And yet at the same time as they say this, Khrushchev has followed an almost contradictory line, both in domestic economics and also in diplomacy. In economics, as soon as he says that the United States is a beaten horse, he says in the next sentence that we must catch up and overtake the United States. In diplomacy, as soon as he destroyed the summit conference in May, as soon as he disinvited one American president, he laid the groundwork for an invitation to the next administration for discussion. But the point is, I think, that the United States must earn the respect of the Soviet Union. And I think this is not a terribly difficult thing to do if you understand Soviet psychology. I think that there are two things that you can do right away. The first thing, when the new administration comes in, is to call for, in anticipation of Khrushchev's call for an emergency session of the General Assembly on disarmament, to call for a foreign minister's discussion to reach an agreement on a nuclear test ban. And secondly, to have someone like Adlai Stevenson, globally respected, speaking at the United Nations, call for a Russian-American joint program of economic aid under UN auspices to the underdeveloped areas of the world.
Has Khrushchev already rejected that? Such idea of a joint program?
My point is to seize initiative, and I think these are the ways that you can do it.
Yeah. We have turned down lots of things the Russians have proposed. And they keep right on proposing and collecting propaganda nickels and dimes on it.
Marvin, we'd better not propose a joint Russian-American. If we ever propose that without asking the French, the British, and the Germans to come in on it, we're going to be in more trouble.
Well, I'm not sure, though, that this is not the kind of thing that the Russians would respect the most. and be most frightened of. I'm not interested, really, in Soviet fear of the United States. I'm interested in Soviet respect for the United States. And I have a feeling that if the Soviet government could only match the respect that the Soviet people have for America, this would be a great achievement.
Yeah. Gentlemen, what do you see as the immediate or ultimate danger points as you look around the world? Winston?
Well, in Africa, of course, there's a time bomb ticking away all the time in the Union of South Africa, which is the last big bastion of white supremacy, but that seems to be a long-term danger. The immediate danger is still the Congo. The possibility of a crack-up of the United Nations force, with five countries now threatening to pull their troops out of the UN command. The possibility even that the Russians may in the end have their way and get the United Nations out of the Congo. And if that happens, of course, there would be complete chaos and collapse and a breakup of the Congo itself, and the whole area would be open wide to all the dangers and pressures of the Cold War.
I think a Washington correspondent would be tempted to say that the most dangerous single spot in the world is the Rules Committee of the House of Representatives, which has the power of life and death over any plans that are put forward to it and has frequently exercised the power of death rather than life.
Well, the UN, of course, is terribly worried about the Congo and about Laos, because in either place a civil war can start, bring in the outside the supporters of the Cold War and turn it into a Spanish civil war. And inside the UN, of course, there is great fear that the Russians will succeed in wrecking it.
Well, and Algeria, of course, is terribly, terribly dangerous, and yet, at the same time, very hopeful. It's a curious thing in the affairs of men. Sometimes there's almost equal reason to hope and to despair. If they ended this Algerian thing just right, why, it would open up a whole new vista of a Euro-African connection. And you know, Ed, peace has never been so close in Algeria, and disaster has never been so imminent.
Well, this is the first time, Ed, I've spoken for Germany, and when you get to the point of talking about the flashpoints, danger points, one doesn't have to do much thinking from Germany. You just say Berlin. As I said before, I don't think there'll be much trouble in the next few months, but Khrushchev has said that he wants that problem solved in 1961 and plans to do it. It's been with us for 2 years. There's some hope that we can keep him talking. I don't think he's quite so foolish as to let us keep him talking indefinitely. I think that the Chinese pressure on him to show results, where results can be achieved, will increase his desire to do something in the coming year. I think that somewhere from April on, that Berlin will tend to become a real danger point, and we can watch it with horrified fascination, because there's nothing we can do about it except wait for the threat to come and then hope that we'll just stand firm. There's nothing to propose and nothing to do about it.
I'm not so sure, really, that Khrushchev is even anxious for a solution in 1961. There have been many indications in Moscow, unofficial leaks, so-called, where Russians have told Western diplomats, propose something, anything, to keep discussions going on Berlin.
Well, Alex, what ominous things do you see on the horizon?
Well, I've got a real flashpoint. I do mean flash. If Israel blows a bomb, can Egypt be far behind? In other words, the continuing spread of the bomb, the possibility that the bomb will continue to spread even among the smallest and most backward countries.
That's not very imminent, Alex. Perhaps we ought to say, since there's been so much discussion.
It frightens me, I'll tell you that.
Well, I think the whole question of the atom bomb is frightening, but on the specific point of Israel, I think we ought to say and make it clear that the Israeli government has denied, the French government have denied.
I use Israel as an example, that's all.
Well,
a symbol.
There's the two obvious ones. There's Laos, which could develop into something very bad if the Soviet Union, this recent shooting up of the American plane, which was watching the Soviet plane drop supplies to its side. And, of course, there's our old friend Kimoi and Matsu in the offshore islands in the Strait of Formosa. And the whole question of China and our relations to China come into this. I proposed, I think, and it was nothing new, 3 years ago, you know, the old two-China policy. We recognize Peking for representing mainland China, and nationalist China represent Formosa. But that there's one thing that both Chinas agree on, and that there are not two Chinas, and that Formosa is an integral part of China, whoever runs it. And now it's within the Chinese power to create an incident wherever it wants to on its periphery, and it can do this with Kimoi and Matsu very easily. Mr. Kennedy brought the subject up in the campaign, and it's a quicksilver deal. I mean, a mercury thing. It's all very well to say that Kimoi and Matsu genuinely belong to the mainland. They do. They're 5 miles off the coast. But the people on those islands do not want to go there. Just as, while both Chinas agree that Formosa belongs to the mainland, most Formosans will tell you quietly that they would like to go their own economic way, preferably under a UN trusteeship, and a pox on all mainland Chinese.
Well, now, gentlemen, you're not going to expect me to summarize this discussion at any point, I'm sure, and being naturally lazy, I'm going to ask you to do it. What must we do to be saved? One solid, firm recommendation from each one of you. Winston?
Well, Ed, I think we have to do something very definite to restore our leadership in Africa. Compare our position with the Russians. The Russians in this past year have been remarkably successful in identifying themselves with the anti-colonialist movement. We, as far as I can see, have done nothing to identify ourselves with African nationalism and its aspirations. We have done one very extraordinary thing, which I think in a way is mistaken, and that is that we have made an international agency, the United Nations, the instrument of our national policy. I think it was right that we did what we did at the time, that when the UN went into the Congo, but I think we have made a mistake in hiding behind and continuing to hide behind the United Nations without showing our own face, tying our whole policy to this world body, which more and more is simply an assembly of small countries with a voice much bigger than their actual power. I don't mean that we should act outside against the United Nations or without consulting the UN. But I think the United States must do something, must act in its own name in order to make its leadership known and its role felt on Africa's side.
Get to the head of the
What must we do to be saved, Howard?
Ed, I have three recommendations. Education, more education, and still more education. I think the time has come to revolutionize American education, and we can do it and create a generation of Americans prepared to cope with the world today, and also try to make America the educational mecca of all the underdeveloped countries, the way Paris used to be the educational mecca of all the people in Eastern Europe.
I think the first thing we ought to do, and above all, is to look into ourselves to find out what we want, then to use our immense power still to push the world ahead in that direction. We have got, and I'll take a leaf out of Marvin's book, we've got to earn the respect of our allies, too, because the French and the British, if they can push us around against our better judgment, are not going to respect us. I think, and I'm certain of this, that if the United States, with its economy producing at full blast, knowing what it wants, ready to fight for what it considers right, pulls itself together, it will automatically have the leadership and the respect needed to ensure peace, and justice and progress.
Richard, I find myself in the unfortunate position of agreeing with you. It doesn't happen on every year-end show. But you're right. We've got to have not only our allies respect us, but our non-allies, right, too. If I could make a recommendation to the President of the United States, who might take advice from an older man, and I am 2 years older than he is, I would say we have an enormous opportunity in Algeria, and we're going to be judged throughout Africa and Asia by what we do in Algeria. I would send a trusted agent to Algeria to tell Mr. Abbas something like this. The United States of America is committed to freedom, and we will stand for the freedom of Algeria, and you can count upon us. But we are also deeply committed to our ally, the French, and we see no reason whatsoever for freedom for Algeria being accomplished through the humiliation of France. We suggest that you try it De Gaulle's way. He's offered you a vote on self-determination. Let the vote be held. Tell your people to vote yes. The United States will be behind you. There'll be no trickery. If there is, you can always start your revolution again. And I would then say to the French, we're behind you too, but do it fast and get it over with right away. And let's not be blackmailed, bullied, or told that they're going to join the communists. Let's be American.
My views are colored, Ed, by where I've lately been. And as seen from West Germany, the way toward salvation is going to be able to afford to do the things we're supposed to do in this world, by keeping our troops in Germany and their dependents as well. And I'm afraid the only proposal I can make is one that won't ever get me elected to anything. It is to tax, it is to enforce discipline on the American people, to make them realize, if we can make them realize, that public good and public causes are more important right now than private affluence. And it's all terribly unpopular, and if we can't do it, I'm not sure there is any salvation.
Alex?
This is an unrehearsed show, and therefore all I can say is what everybody else has said, but in my own way. I think we all have the same idea. Let us try to lead, but not depending on force, rather on force of example.
I say we have to try to get some modus vivendi with the Chinese, which is not going to be easy because I don't know whether they want to recognize us. We have a very important position in their demonology. We're the Satan incarnate. We're the big bogeyman that they can always use to get an extra ounce of sweat and blood out of their own people as a threat. Well, we've got to do that. I also think we've got to get a new formula for dealing with our close allies who support us. Now, I was present at the revolution in April in Korea, and it did me good because for once we bet right with our embassy there. And when President Rhee was thrown out and the American ambassador went to the presidential palace, I saw something that brought a lump as big as a baseball in my throat. I saw the American ambassador being cheered by a mob. In other words, we were backing a revolution instead of bucking one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the sort of thing I think we've got to do. And I think another thing we might do is missiles get longer, we could voluntarily reduce bases, possibly, in some of the areas where they are not very popular.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ed, I'd like to make one specific and very topical proposal. It might be a little bold. I think that in recognition of the fact that half of Communist China's cultivated land that was admitted today is now in drought, and there is mass starvation on the mainland of Communist China, that the United States propose to send a good deal of its surplus wheat to feed the people of China.
Will the government take it?
This is our proposal.
That doesn't make
it
refuse.
No,
all right.
Take it
or
not. Howard, it is now possible, don't you think, in this country to engage in a serious discussion regarding the recognition of Communist China?
I think it is, and I think it will probably get more so. The Undersecretary of State, Mr. Chester Bowles, has spoken very boldly on the subject in the past, and I presume necessity will make us speak more boldly on it in the future. This is a stone wall. We can't bat our heads against
it. It's less a recognition of Red China than a recognition of reality.
That's right. Well, don't we have two gentlemen over in Warsaw, Jake Beam and his Chinese opposite number, who have been playing double solitaire for nearly 2 years.
Presumably this will go on. Gentlemen, I am going to try to sum this up. A friend of mine once asked a friend of his to interpret for him Shakespeare's wonderful phrase, "What's past is prelude." And the man said, "You ain't seen nothing yet." I think that's what you have all said. Thank you very much, and I hope you have good news to report. Good night, and good luck.